creating a strong and sustainable practice. So I think most of us find that our practice, our Buddhist practice, helps us stay sane, resilient, grateful, compassionate. I mean, it just, our practice, generally speaking, helps our whole life go better, especially during challenging times. But at the same time, it can be very difficult, just like just many other healthy habits, it can be very difficult to find the time or the energy or the discipline, the motivation, enthusiasm to practice the way we think we should, or even just the way that we really want to. So I want to talk about that today and how various ways that we can give form and structure to our practice. So first of all, we want to set this as, you know, traditionally Buddhist practice happened in a monastic setting. So from the time of the Buddha and really until recently, most people outside monasteries, and I would say lay people, but it's not really lay versus monastic. It's about the setting that you're in. Because I'm a priest, right? But I'm not living in a monastery. So I face the same challenges that any of lay people do. So I'll just say like kind of inside and outside a monastic setting. So traditionally, those outside a monastic setting didn't really expect to practice the way that those in a monastery did. You know, there were devotional practices, and maybe keeping the basic precepts or something like that, but the expectations weren't the same, that you would be able to maintain a practice the way that we think about it. Rather, you supported the monks in doing this, and then they would teach you and give you wisdom, but the people who were in the monastery were the ones that was understood that's the setting that was the recommended venue for Buddhist practice. And, you know, this is because monasticism has taken many different forms in Buddhism over the years in different countries and stuff like that. But it generally means that you have a set of vows and expectations. You're in a community where everybody's doing the same thing. There's a full schedule. Like, you just do what's next on the schedule. You don't decide. You just follow the schedule and you're going to get plenty of meditation and study and you know, silence and mindful activity, and all of these things are just built into the structure of your life. So, and we taste this sometimes in a way at our meditation retreats. It's like a little week of monastic practice, a little week of this residential full-time communal practice where we eat together and everything in the schedule and in the environment is designed to point you toward the Dharma. So it's very supportive. It's not easy. It's not always easy. That has its own difficulties, but that's a topic for another day. So from the beginning, it's been understood that trying to practice outside a monastery is much more difficult. And many of these reasons that, I mean, I don't, I'm going to go over the reasons why it's difficult, but I don't really need to tell any of you about them. Changing circumstances. So, you know, in the monastery, it's kind of the same thing all the time, right? There can be this stable schedule, stable structure, stable environment. Whereas kind of by nature, life outside a monastery is much more changeable. I mean, and different people have different levels of this in their lives. Sometimes people have very stable lives, but oftentimes, especially if you have family, kids, other responsibilities, trying to establish a structure, establish habits, it can be difficult to maintain them, because just when you get it all set up, then the whole situation changes and your schedule changes and where you have to be changes and your responsibilities change. And so it's difficult to come up with a good system or structure that works, and then you don't have to worry about it. We obviously have competing responsibilities, demands, distractions. So practice needs diligent maintenance. Often feels almost like we have to, protect our practice against these distractions or responsibilities. There's tension created. And then, of course, there is the lack of social support. So we really have to rely so much on our own self-discipline, our own level of motivation. So there's a reason why Sangha is one of the three jewels. So you probably have heard this one before, but so the Buddha himself emphasized that associating with what he called admirable people was essential to our success in practice. He defined admirable people as wise practitioners who are firm in their conviction that spiritual practice is important, are strong in virtue, generosity, and discernment. And then this is a quote from the Pali Canon. So the Venerable Ananda, one of the Buddha's disciples, went to the Blessed One and said to him, "This is half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." The Blessed One responds, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable friends, as admirable people, as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." So from the beginning, Sangha has been emphasized, and I think all of us would agree, I mean, here we are, right, that Sangha is important, and that, but in our lives, even if we're incredibly dedicated and we show up to Sangha meetings more than once a week, that's still very, very little compared to that monastic setting where we would be living together, eating together, chanting together, just, you know, all of that. So outside a monastery, how do we give our practice some form? So it needs some kind of form, some kind of structure, shape, physical manifestation, because this is just the way that human beings work. Now, most, maybe you might even say at the deepest level, our practice is subtle and formless. I mean, at the deepest level, I like to think of practice as being living deliberately. So, you know, in each moment, turning toward wisdom, turning toward compassion, not just being carried along by habit energy, not being oblivious, living deliberately. So that's pretty subtle, and it doesn't necessarily look any particular way. It's not tied to any particular, you know, practices. And that's great, and that's still true, but we do need support. We need our practice to have some kind of form. So somewhere in our lineage, there became the terms monk of body and monk of mind. So they meant a monk of body was this, you know, in the monastery, right? The body is being put through the forms of practice. And that outside the monastery, we were aspiring to be monks of mind. That we weren't necessarily physically enacting the formal practices, but we were trying to fulfill the Buddha Dharma in our you know, in our moment to moment in our minds. But there was an emphasis that if you're in a monastery and you're just a monk of body and you're not doing, you're not a monk of mind, then, you know, you're wasting your time. And then similarly, outside the monastery, you know, we're going to be a hybrid. We're a monk of mind, but we also need to manifest and create some structure and form in our practice. So despite the changing life circumstances, competing responsibilities, distractions, limited social support, we need a lot of determination, creativity, and flexibility to give our practice some form. So this metaphor, I don't know if it's a metaphor or an analogy, occurred to me that it's like we're sitting at a potter's wheel and we have a lump of clay in front of us, which is our practice. And the wheel is turning and we're trying to form it. We're trying to keep it, to give it some kind of shape. And it's a changing dynamic things. Maybe sometimes the wheel's going faster, sometimes slower. We need to pay attention. We need to put forth some effort, some pressure. But the turning never ends. We never end up with like, okay, now we've got our nice pot and we can go bake it and it's done. And now I know what my practice is going to look like. It's like we're just, it's by the nature of it, we're just, and this is probably true of being in a monastery as well. It's just a never ending process. We're being engaged with this, giving our practice a form, but we never get to just turn our attention away from it. And to some extent, it can actually help our practice if we just accept that this is the case. That you know, you can give up those expectations. It's going to look a certain way for good. That it's, you know, it's always, accept that it's always going to be a moving target, but also not giving up. Not just walking away from the potter's wheel and letting the clay dry up. So, before I get on to then all the ways that we can help, the tools that we have, the practical tools we have to give shape to our practice, I will do the breakouts and give you the question. If you could give your practice more form, what would you like to add to it? What would you like to strengthen? And you know, we're going to be following this up with how to do that and how to, and also how to accept our own limitations. And I don't want to phrase this in terms of inadequacy, because I think there's always something that we have an edge of our practice, no matter what. There's always some point of growth. What could we work on? What could we deepen? None of us are complete Buddhas, right? So there's always something that we could do to give our practice more form. What would you like to add to it or strengthen? So I will get the, and we'll just do it for 10 minutes. So I guess I will go ahead and just open the rooms that we had before. All right, welcome back, everyone. Start off with getting clear about all the forms practice can take. So some of you are familiar with the formulation of Zen practice that I came up with called the 9 fields of Zen practice. And from the beginning of my practice, I've always, my mind's been cogitating on how I can describe and communicate. So I feel like this list of 9 fields covers pretty much everything that I can think of in Zen practice. And I composed it largely in order to point people toward many aspects of their lives that they might not ordinarily think of as practice. So the fields are Zazen, obviously, Dharma study, cultivating insight, which takes a little more explanation, but precept work, opening the heart, so working with metta and relationships, connecting with the ineffable, just like last week I talked about suchness, and that's something that I think is often left out of formulations of practice. According with the Dharma and everyday activities, which I call Nyoho, which is something that in monastic practice, based on your vows and based on the traditions of the monastery, you would be enacting, but we can also adapt that to our everyday lives. And then karma work, facing this unique karmic package that we are, and patiently sorting out our karmic knots, taking responsibility, and bodhisattva activity. So much more can be said on that, and I have several podcast episodes on that. But essentially, this is about learning to see every aspect of our life as practice, so that we don't compartmentalize and put efforts in certain areas and then slack off because, well, this isn't practice. I'm just watching Netflix. This isn't practice. But really seeing is like every moment of your life can be practice. And it shouldn't just be an add-on to our already busy lives. So this is in some ways, this is saying, you know, you should be paying attention to each moment of your life as practice. But in another way, this is another approach to this conundrum about how to find space for practice in a busy life outside a monastery. It's like, well, maybe start to see everything you do, your work, your relationships, how you keep your house, how you choose to spend your time, all those things. If you see all of that as opportunities to practice, then you have more time and space to practice in a way. So part of what sometimes it may seem like in Soto Zen in particular, because we don't have a koan curriculum, what are you supposed to be doing anyway? And I think that's pretty typical to have that question. I think it reveals itself over time. If you really stick with the practice, you know, over the years you start to go, oh, you know, things really are changing. They really are shifting. It's individual for each of us. It's not necessarily like, well, what should I work on? It's like, well, just engage the practice and stuff will happen. But it is helpful. I think one thing that we're looking for is learning how to see things through the lens of our Zen practice. So that's one of the primary functions of Zen teachers, is not to, you know, give you great profound answers or advice or something, but to, okay, so you're working with this, you're struggling with this, you're thinking of this, this is how this fits into our practice, or here's a practice that relates, here's a teaching that relates. So helping us recognize and step up to those opportunities. So in addition to kind of expanding your sense of practice and including more, I'm going to talk about the power of vow. So this is a big Buddhist thing. I said, or tapping into what you really want. So Zen Master Dogen, I'm sure he didn't make up this story, he's just quoting it from somewhere else, but he tells a story about a prostitute who puts on a monk's okesa, the monk's robe, as a joke. So you can see this prostitute dancing around like, look, I'm a nun, you know. But then in a subsequent lifetime, she becomes a nun. So it's like there's a certain that certain, there's a little bit of a resonance, a little bit of an intention that comes to fulfillment. So in some senses, we make vows or we have intentions, and they don't work the way that we think they would, or the way that we would like them to, which is, here's an executive I've decided what's good for us, all of these different aspects of myself. I have promised to do this vow, and now I'm going to make all these different aspects of myself obey, and then we will fulfill this vow and achieve what we want to achieve. I've known, out of the hundreds of Zen practitioners I know of, I could count them on one hand, probably, the people who seem to have that kind of self-discipline. And like, they could be alone on a desert island and they would just practice exactly the way they think they should practice. But nobody else that I know of is like that. So we make these vows, and part of our practice is to practice with vow. So it's not just our practice is to make vows and fulfill them, but it's to learn about vows, to learn about how to make a vow, how to not over aspire to make a reasonable vow, and to relate to it. Many of you have heard me say this before, but when we make a vow or intention and then we fail at it, I said, keep the vow around. So even when we fail at it, we keep it around because it reflects some aspect of our own aspiration. So this is very similar to, right, like people with addictions, right? You relapse, you start over. Because you don't like, well, never mind, I failed at that. Like you start over because there's a reason you made that vow. You wanted it to give shape to your life. So vows need to be wielded gently by most of us. So when I first encountered Buddhism and vow, I was like, oh, this is awesome. I'm gonna vow to do this. I'm gonna get up early and I'm gonna stop getting angry and I'm going to be kind to people and I'm gonna, you know, all these vows. And I would just fail at them. So that's when I'm kind of using it as a, you know, executive eye bludgeon, right? But you can also, you know, so you can play with the wording around it. Sometimes vow might be too strong. Maybe it's an intention. I intend to sit zazen 3 days a week or something like that. Here's another one you might try. I want to. I want to sit more zazen. I want to be a better listener. I want to. And even another way to do this is, may I be attentive for the rest of this zazen period? And it's a strange thing because I don't think of there being bodhisattvas or deities out there who are going to grant my wish. So in a way, it's a kind of weird, like, why would I be kind of praying? But I don't think we need to imagine some external force that is going to bring this, make this happen. What we're doing is we're expressing this wish and also at the same time recognizing that somehow we don't seem to have direct control over this. So it's a very gentle way of saying, may I be more attentive, may I wake up, may I be more gentle, may I be more, I don't know, have a moment of reflection when I get caught up in anger or something like that. So, and another one thing before to say about vow before we move on is I also recommend, if you have any struggle with vow and intention, to set ridiculously low expectations for yourself. to make an intention, you know, make a vow, make an intention, whatever, a statement that sounds like just ridiculously easy. Like, okay, I am going to sit, I'll sit for 10 minutes, 3 days a week. And you think that's that, who cares? That's no big deal. But if it's more than you're doing now, then it's a start. So I find that sometimes that, and then you can build from there, and fulfilling that intention actually has a positive feedback experience, you know, can lead to you actually wanting to do more than that. So then on to very critical aspect of giving form to our practice, and that is social support, or the treasure of Sangha. So this is a quote that I've used many times from Thich Nhat Hanh in the heart of the Buddha's teaching. He says, Sangha is the fourfold community of monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen, as well as the other elements that support our practice. In my country, we say that when a tiger leaves the mountain and goes to the lowlands, he will be caught by humans and killed. When a practitioner leaves her sangha, she may abandon her practice and die as a practitioner. Practicing with a sangha is essential. So, you know, sangha is one of the three treasures. We're just social beings, human beings. We're social. We're incredibly social. The only kind of creature that's more social is bees. You know, we're deeply, deeply, we don't even, if we don't have interaction with one another, we don't develop language, and we don't even develop full capability of our brain. We were so interdependent. So I personally, I need this support. I have enough structure in my practice. And that's because I have to show up on Tuesdays and have to show up on Sundays. And I scheduled online meditation that I have to show up for other days of the week. So, like, it almost seems like cheating in a way, right? But hey, whatever works. So I created that structure by making this commitment to Sangha. And I heard the abbot of a monastery once say that she had chosen to live in community. And this is somebody who you just, like, you know, they're a Zen master, right? They've been practicing for decades and they're so wise. And she said she chose to live in community because otherwise she'd never sit. And when I heard that, I was like, ah, like, that's so encouraging in a strange way, to know that even somebody like that really needed the support of other people in order to practice. So, you know, I have another example. Like, I'm unable to pretty much make myself exercise. But if I'm signed up for an exercise class and I need to show up, it's no problem. Why? Like, why? It's not like the people at the gym are personally looking for me and are going to give me a hard time if I don't show up. But just a little bit of obligation makes a big difference. Because if we're relying on just what we want to do, what we feel inclined to do at any moment, then of course it's going to be a moment where we're like, I don't want to do that. I don't feel like sitting zazen. I don't feel like, so if we're just following our own motivation, our own sense of inspiration, then it's very changeable and unreliable usually. But then later we'll feel regret that we didn't fulfill our intention, because we set the intention for a reason, right? We know it's good for our health. We know it's good for our practice. We know it helps us be more compassionate people, whatever. We had a good reason. So in addition to helping us stay true to our intentions, Sangha also gives us what I call positive peer pressure. So I don't think most of us can sit like for a week for about 7 or 8 hours a day in silence. Like we just, yeah. But if we're with other people and they're doing it, I can do it. Even once it starts to really hurt, well, they're still sitting still. I can still sit still. Maybe even at each Zazen period feels like this. So as long as other people are doing it, right? And then also staying in contact helps keep us, carry us through our own motivation legs. So this is a similar thing where you, if you just have a habit built up of showing up to Sangha, and sometimes, yay, it's so great. And sometimes you're like, I don't know. You know, I don't know if my practice is good or what this is all for or whatever. But then you show up and other people are enthused and it helps. It just helps sustain over time. So in terms of our Sangha participation when we're not in a monastery, obviously we can attend these kinds of Sangha events. But there's also many ways to become more deeply engaged, studying and taking the precepts. We have numerous study groups going now, speaking up, you know, showing up in the breakout rooms, asking questions, volunteering, cultivating Sangha friendships, and, you know, meeting with the teacher. So, let's see. And then I guess in just a couple more things. I think it can be valuable in trying to maintain and establish a form for our practice in the midst of busy lives. If we see doing so, we see taking care as part, in service to, as part of our work, as part of our responsibility to other people, you know, we recognize that this, it's not just selfish. It's not just taking space away from what we should be doing, that sitting Zazen, even taking a week off for a session, you know, helps us be active in our lives. And I don't, each of us is different in terms of how we feel about that. But I know for myself, I feel lots of responsibility and competing demands. And it just, you know, it's easy to think like I don't have time for that. But to take time for the nourishing, quiet, what spirit, you know, nourishes us spiritually is obviously very important for our practice over time. And then finally, doing whatever it takes. So our obstacles can be that we think we can or should do it all on our own. We might have a fixed idea about what practice should look like. Refusal to accept how practice is actually manifesting for us. We had a way we wanted it to look and it's not looking that way. So this requires creativity, thinking outside the box in order to provide ourselves with the support, inspiration, and structure. So, you know, because sometimes people will ask me, you know, as a teacher, like, well, should I be doing this or that? Or is it okay if I use this to support my practice? And it's like, if it helps you to try to keep a streak going on Insight Timer, go for it. Jim and I were doing that for a while where like on this app, you know, each day you log on and you sit and then it'll keep track of how many days in a row you sit. And we had a streak going and like one day, you know, your internet connection didn't work and it's like, no, my streak is broken, which is totally silly, right? Like it's a weird thing to juxtapose with Zazen, but hey, whatever works to get us on the cushion, or making a bet with a friend that you'll fulfill a vow, or then you'll owe them dinner, or if you incorporate your intentions into a prayer to God or Jesus, whatever works. It's the results that matter. And what is that result? I guess it feels like your practice has some satisfying form. Not necessarily that it's filling an ideal, but that you feel engaged. You know, you're at that potter's wheel, you're paying attention, you feel the clay under your hands. You know, it may not be the most beautiful lump of clay, but you're doing your best. You haven't walked away from it. You haven't, made the clay fall off by pushing it too hard. You're involved in the process, mindful and appreciative. So leave it there. We'd have a few minutes left for questions or comments. Could just go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something to say.
Well, I was just thinking, I always see things through a 12-step lens. And a lot of times people who are new in the program, they assign them a job to make coffee or set up the chairs or something like that. And, they call it service work. And they're only supposed to do it for a certain period of time and then pass it on to somebody else. But that gets you, it's like, you're going to go to the AA meeting because on Tuesday you have to make the coffee. So.
Yeah. And that's one of the, well, we still have a few jobs. We have a guest master. We have people who keep time and do the instruments and stuff like that. And they have to show up. But, at the Zen Center, of course, we have more stuff that we have to take care of. So that's one thing that I miss, is that it's a great way. I got to show up.
Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful that you picked this topic. It's like a how-to of getting things going. And it's not like I haven't been doing that to myself in all aspects of my life for decades. But there is something unique about the practice and conceptualizing what it entails. So I'm very grateful that you picked this topic.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, it's interesting you said that about having a streak, so many days meditate, because I was watching and there was someone interviewing Jerry Seinfeld, asking how they were able to come up with these wonderful episodes, that became just one of the most watched TV shows of all time. And he said, because we had a calendar and we would put one X when we started thinking of something, and then we wouldn't leave until we had something and we could put the other line to make a complete X. So psychologically, and by the way, he meditates every day. So it seems to be something that works.
I like it. Well, that is where, we have so many options, which is great. I mean, that's one of the reasons I like, living the way I do instead of in a monastery.
This was very helpful.
Great. Shintai, did you have something to say?
I was going to say, I liked what you had to say about making like ridiculously easy vows. I have found that has been very helpful for me, because it's sometimes like embarrassing to set the bar so low, but yet it is more than I was doing, right? It also points me to like sometimes that critical moment in practice for me has been, what do I do when I fall short of my aspiration, right? What do I do when I do fall short of those vows? And like that's such like a key moment for me of like, because there's a way that you can, it's niggling in the back of your mind, but you're like, I'm just forgetting. I'm not going to do it. I'm just forgetting, you know. So just getting back on that horse, figuring out what's going to work. Maybe that way of supporting my practice or that structure was too much or not right or my life changed. But like, seems like it's like this constant willingness to be honest with how it's going and just keep trying. Because I think I can go through these kind of fallow periods of practice where it's just like, it's not working, but I don't really quite want to admit that it's not working. So, anyway, that's just my two cents on that. So it's great to just hear all your kind of tips and ideas about like, how do we support that structure and this acknowledgement, like for me, it feels like anytime my routine changes, practice is really fragile. So the formal parts, you know, so then I got to reinvent it all over again, and that life changes a lot. And all of us have gone through a lot of change in the last, like in these times of pandemic. So anyway, thank you. It's great.
Did I miss any great tips? Not to put you on the spot, but
nothing came immediately to mind that I would have thought, oh, you know, nothing really came immediately to mind other than just knowing that like that's the key. For me, I know I've had this conversation with myself and with others a lot, like the key moment is figuring it out when you fall short. Like that's like such a pivotal moment to being a long-term practitioner is being able to do that. So that's all I did.
Cool. Because they just keep the vows around.
Yeah.
But also to make them, you know, what we do, what the Nine Fields study group is doing and what we do in Term Student is to make them also time limited. Like, I don't know. I'm starting to think of making the recommendation, like maybe we should only make vows for a month at a time and then reevaluate at the end of the month, because then there's less of that sense of failure, because you might have to be like, all right, let's focus on something else. Clearly that's not really going to work. All right. Well, I will do a little dedication. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.